This week's episode of The Rebooted Show is brought to you by Beehive, the platform trusted by enterprise publishers like Newsweek and Time. Newsweek is in the midst of an exciting transformation. With AI disrupting search traffic, they're building direct relationships with their audience through newsletters. Bharat Qureshi, Newsweek's chief product officer, spoke about why they chose Beehive. And he said that Beehive's consumer-first, tech-driven DNA was exactly what they were looking for. That B2C background ended up growing their tool into being enterprise ready. Newsweek has aggressive newsletter plans designed around adding new audiences and launching new products. With more industry leaders like Newsweek migrating to Beehive and 2026 planning in full effect, now's the time to see how Beehive can take your content to the next level. If you want to see what your next stage of growth could look like, go to beehive.com/TRB. That is spelled beehive.com/TRB. And meet with Beehive's team of growth and newsletter experts today. Thank you so much to Beehive for their support. Welcome to The Rebooting Show. I am Brian Morrissey. I'm joined today by Helena Botemiller Evich. I hope I got that right. We talked about me mispronouncing her name, but so let's assume that's very close. That's very nice. Helena is the proprietor, I guess. We'll get into what titles we're going to use, of FoodFix, which is a subscription-based food policy intelligence newsletter that delivers insider reporting and analysis to professionals working at the intersection of government, industry, and public health. Helena started this after covering food and ag issues at Politico for nearly a decade. She's won awards. She's even spent some time in the B2B world at Food Safety News. I like that. I love B2B publications.
I straddle B2B and B2C.
I know.
Proudly.
Proudly, yes. Because at Politico, you were part of Politico Pro, right? And so you left to start FoodFix in 2022. That's actually when this is the first time we're talking live, but we've exchanged emails.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to quote from one that you sent to me, if you don't mind.
Bring the receipts.
The Tim Russert. RIP. You said, I really do think there's something to this creator boom. Journalists have been much slower to pick up on it because we don't consider ourselves creators, but it's basically just an editorial first approach or content first approach, even though we hate the term content. I think you sum up the distaste that a lot of journalists have for whatever this is that a lot of them are being attracted to or being forced into, which is going off on their own and building their own businesses, which is you've been doing for the last 3 years. So start off with what led you to leave Politico to think there's a lane to do this as a solo enterprise, whether it's creator or we call it something else.
Yeah, I'd been at Politico for about a decade and really got to know the model there. I helped launch the food and ag vertical they had back in 2013. So I'd been there almost a decade and I was ready to do something else. I'd been covering food policy the whole time. Like, I really had owned and loved covering food policy. I was ready to do something else. And I basically just came to the realization that no other national media outlet was going to post the job I wanted. Like, I could go try to convince editors at, you know, New York Times or wherever to like create this beat, but they didn't see it as a beat that was worth covering or that was important to cover. And it was during a time when I think a lot more media entrepreneurs were being really open about how they were building. Like, I started listening to all the Morning Brew, you know, every podcast for every like media operator I started listening to. And the more I listened as a reporter, like inside the Politico newsroom, I was like, I actually know more about how this works than I maybe thought. And I would have never considered myself an entrepreneur. Like, never. But
that's another term that needs to be retired.
It started to dawn on me that I could maybe do it. And I have had readers since be like, are you good at picking stocks? Because you like picked the perfect topic at the perfect time, because now we're in a MAHA world and everyone's talking about food policy. Yeah. And I find this hysterical. But no, I love my beat. I own my beat. And I saw the white space because so many media outlets don't see this as a beat. So there's a clear, wide open lane, and I saw it, and I decided to launch FoodFix. I left Politico right after covering the infant formula crisis. I was really the top reporter covering that. Loved working at Politico, but just was ready to do something else. And I took the leap. And now I look back and I'm like, wow, that was good timing. But I didn't really see where all this was headed at the time.
But you were coming from Politico Pro, yep. Right? And that is a B2B arm of Politico that has high price subscription. So, you know, yep. people were mm-hmm. already paying for yep. what you were doing.
Yeah, but Politico, the beauty of it is that Pro really is hybrid because a lot of the top reporters are still writing for Politico.com. So you have to be able to, you know, write for an insider audience, really know your stuff, do those incremental scoops, and then also be able to zoom out and write for a mainstream audience. And I remember being in all hands once where our then owner, Robert Albritton, who eventually sold Politico to Axel Springer, and he said something along the lines of Politico Pro is a way to tax the 1% to pay for a newsroom. And I will never forget that line because it was really true. Like basically they were figuring out how to have a really strong business model around a B2B, you know, information services, like really insidery trade pub, basically a bunch of trade yeah. publications, right? And then that leveraged them to have the best reporters and these huge teams of reporters that you would never have at other publications. Yeah. And then when healthcare blew up or a farm bill blew up, we had the best teams in the country covering these. And so I came to really love that model and I basically emulate it with Food Fix. So I'm actually half paid, half free. So paid subscribers get Food Fix twice a week. And free, I have a free list, gets it once a week. Anyone can get it, foodfix.co. Anyone interested in food policy. And, you know, there's a lot going on right now. So,
yeah. So just to go back there, what gave you confidence on like the business side? Because I think I feel like there's always, and you flicked at it a little bit, but there can be trepidation with the capital J journalist. You're a capital J journalist.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. No, I'm a journalist first, second, and third. Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Uh-huh. Right? And then there's the business stuff, right? Which I think some people think it's more complicated, really, than it is. I mean, it's a pain in the ass, but like it's, you know, the merchant class is the merchant class. Yeah, journalists, you can become part.
We try to sully ourselves.
You can become part of the merchant class. Trust me, it's just a lot of like thankless work. But I think it's intimidating for a lot of like journalists, just because it's unfamiliar.
I was intimidated. I also though became a little bit less intimidated as I dug in more. So I did
like,
a lot
I could do this.
Oh yeah, yeah. So I talked to a lot of people. Like you know, I talked to Anna Palmer and John Bresnahan, who launched Punchbowl out of Politico. There were a lot of ex-business people from Politico Pro who jumped on the phone with me and talked me through like how things worked. I had a vague idea of how the business worked. Politico Pro is a really high price point. I think by the time I left, you couldn't get it for less than like $7,000. And that would be like a congressional office, like the discounted, you know, rate for government. You know, so it was really high dollar. And I knew that what I was going to do was not going to be every day. I was not going to be on a hamster wheel of breaking news. So I knew my price point was going to be lower. But I wanted to hit that sweet spot where it's premium. So I'm $500 a year for most people. I do a lower rate for government and academia, but $500 a year, you don't necessarily have to have a meeting about that, right? Like someone can just sign up, get their business to expense it for them. And so I actually spent a lot of time trying to figure out pricing. And basically, I realized everyone was guessing on pricing.
Yeah.
I'd like talk to all the business people and be like, okay, like brass tacks, how did you do this? And, you know, they'd be like, look at comps. And I was like, well, there aren't any comps because I'm the only one doing this. Like I have this lane. And so I actually ended up hiring.
And then go higher. Look at comps and then go higher. In B2B, you just go higher because like the difference between 300 and 500, honestly, is not, I've never heard anyone give me or present evidence that there's any formula to these things. Particularly if you're a journalist pricing your information product, go higher because you're going to underprice it usually as a journalist for whatever reason.
Yeah. And like, I just, once I realized that everyone else was guessing or experimenting, I was like, you know, this just isn't expertise that I don't have. Like I can try this too. And I went out of the gate and I sold paid subscriptions on day one and was like, oh, okay. Like, I think this could work. I had some idea that it was going to work. I did think it was really helpful that I left Politico before Elon Musk bought X. And so it was easier to get emails. I had a pretty, you know, substantial following, really engaged following. That is no longer really the case, although I have also not quit X, but it was a lot easier to get emails. So I launched with like something like 1,700 people on my list. And that was really helpful to get going.
Okay. So, that is always, I mean, that's the kind of like, quote unquote, unfair advantage. I mean, it's not unfair because it's earned.
But all journalists, I've been telling all of my friends in media, have an email list. I don't care if you think you're going to be at your publication for the next 20 years. You should have your own list. You should be building some type of like direct connection with your audience. Like, you do not own that social anything. And you don't own the connection you have within your publication. Like, you know, I'd love to have the list of everyone who has subscribed to my stories, you know, in the decade that I was at Politico, but that's not my list. So
yeah, they weren't going to give it to you.
Well,
Vox gave the list to a couple people, but
that was, I heard about that and I thought, well, that was really nice of them.
Yeah, that was really nice. I left Digiday. I left behind the 140,000 email addresses. I had to start from zero.
Yes. But at least, I mean, people knew who you were. They knew your name. And like that counts for a lot. I'm not ever discounting that. But
yeah, I started with 3,000 email subscribers before I sent anything just from, again, thankfully, it was still Twitter then, I guess, because it was actually from a Morning Brew. I think it was Austin, but it might have been Alex that said, anyone leaving a job should always like get people to sign up to an email newsletter because it'll go, you'll get the like, congrats, even if like it's done. That stuck in my mind, even not fully knowing like what I was going to be doing. And it does become an advantage. So when you were thinking about, are you doing the same work now as you were doing at Politico? Or did you tweak it because you're on your own or you wanted to be in a different lane?
So I would say it's similar in some ways. So I think, you know, the subject matter is similar. It's basically the same beat. So I cover like FDA, food labeling, anything consumer facing. So school meals, the SNAP program, you know, which a lot of people still know as food stamps. I mean, these are huge programs. SNAP serves more than 40 million Americans. Like, there's a lot of fights over it. There's a lot at stake. So the subject matter is very much the same. The tone is different. I would never use first person at Politico, and sometimes I do insert a little bit of analysis that's like, I remember when Michelle Obama was, you know, trying to get everyone to eat something different in the school meals program and Republicans lost their minds. You know, I can insert like a little bit of kind of historical analysis and it feels more personal. And I just didn't have that relationship with my audience at Politico. I get more emails now, or even immediately when I launched Food Fix, I would get more reader emails than I ever got at Politico, even though technically I was reaching way fewer people, because it's just different when the person is coming into your inbox.
Yeah.
So it's a highly engaged audience. I very specifically chose to do it twice a week so that I wouldn't get burned out. I was not about to. I talked to Isaac Saul over, you know, I love what he's doing with Tangle, huge fan.
He doesn't have to do it now every day.
But like, he does it.
I ask like, that about that to Emily Sundberg all the time. I'm like, are you burned out? And she gets like a little defensive with him. She's like, I work hard. I'm like, I know it's hard work. Yeah. We all work hard. I just assume that.
Yeah. So I say that. I do it twice a week, but a couple times a year, if I get a really good scoop, I send a special alert. And I call them bonus editions. I never promised. The value prop was never to be like the breaking news source. But, you know, like I knew what was in the dietary guidelines first. So, and it's kind of like my Olympics and food policy, right? You got every 5 years, like every 5 years, the government updates the dietary guidelines. They changed it a bit more this time with RFK Jr.'s stamp on it. And I knew what was in there. So my readers got that first. But a few times a year will I do that. It's really meant to be more analytical. It's meant to be, it's always straddling this line. So, you know, my paid readers are getting both editions, the one that's subscriber only and the free one. And so both of them have to be valuable and have to be readable. And one of the great things I learned at Politico is how to write for both audiences at the same time. So has to be understandable, not a lot of jargon. If there's an acronym, you explain it. My mother-in-law will say, like, I feel like you're explaining the news to me, or like you're kind of holding my hand through the policy news. And that's kind of the goal, is that it's, you know, I have everyone from like CEOs of food companies to like, you know, people who participate in the SNAP program. and want to follow what's going on. And so it really is a diverse audience. And I love that. I know it's kind of weird to do B2B and B2C and like
people advise
against it.
It is kind of dangerous to some way because, you know, you're charging $500 a year. And if you're explaining what Snap is, it would be like me like explaining what CPM is, you know, every single time.
Yeah.
It means cost per thousand, but thousand is melee and like all this, like, and I'm like, I've just chosen
a
more
Snap's
B2B
one
lane.
I don't. What Snap
and
is
I'm
one
like, people can look up what CPM is if they don't know it.
Yes. Yeah. But, you know, I feel like you do a good job of not. It's never, like, too technical and jargony that, you know. Yeah. But
I wonder, because you're subscription only, right? And so
That's the journalist first approach.
Yeah, because you're not making money off these freeloaders.
Not yet.
I'm fully on to the business
side
now.
And so here's the deal. As a reporter, I very much respect having somewhat of a wall between. And like, obviously, when it's just you, you can't have a wall. The reason I love subscription only, and it's been, you know, I've had enough growth and I've had enough success that I can be subscription only for now. The reason I love it is that your incentives are so tightly aligned. Like, it is either worth it to pay for it or not. Yeah. Like, they either are getting the value or not. And that is... there's no crossed wires there. And, you know, I actually haven't had this happen, but if someone hates something and like cancels or angry or whatever, that's one among hundreds. Like, you know, it's not, you don't have the appearance of, you know, sponsored by X company. And most of the money to be made where I am is in advocacy dollars, advocacy ads. But these are the issues I'm covering.
It's a lucrative
These
area.
Are the issues I'm covering. So it just looks like, there's just no way to separate it. And so I've stayed away from that. I'm leaving a ton of money on the table, and I know that. And that's okay with me for now because, like, I prefer to keep it simple and to keep the interests of my audience and the business aligned really nicely. And for now, that's great. So, but I understand the business people generally think this is...
No, this
insane.
would not be a private equity approved approach at all.
No, like
you've got influential policymakers. Yeah. You know, the Washington D.C. influence circuit.
Everyone's reading it.
Is very. There's a lot of people who feed at that trough. You know, you do a view from the top segment with someone who has, you know, some lobbyist dollars, right? And then, you know, you're interviewing, I don't know, someone like a MAHA person. And a bunch of lobbyists come, and that model works. I don't think there's anything wrong necessarily.
No.
I understand the point of keeping it simple, though, because I think that is really, that's key. Because you can go in a lot of different directions. I know, I feel it myself.
Yeah,
sometimes.
And I think I would be feeling differently if I've had really strong year-over-year growth every year that's mostly organic. Like, I'm not spending money on marketing. And... you know, it's working. So I'm not trying to like make the business model more complex right now, but I am fully aware of,
that's
the different
great.
Revenue streams I could be creating. I'm building a platform right now where I can build whatever I want on top of it. I also have, you know, a toddler and a 6-year-old, and like there is beauty in sort of the simplicity of what I'm running. I have only part-time help for Food Fix. And so, you know, I'm covering the Trump administration. I got little kids. Like, I don't need to be...
Like, literally on your plate.
I got a lot, yeah.
Yeah, so how has the growth been? What kind of numbers would you give us?
I mean, at least 10 to 20% every year. So, like, I mean, I am every year growing without... And that's including churn. Like, I have pretty low churn, very... very high auto renewal rate. I think only like 4% of my subscribers have auto renew turned off, which is really great. So it feels strong. It feels stable.
Are you making more than you made at Politico?
Yes. Oh yeah.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
That's the line. You know,
I have a path to hiring people for sure.
Yeah.
But it's like the simplicity of it operationally. I mean, I say that and like, you know, I have like 5 part-time folks, I'm launching a podcast called American Dish, which people can check out. So I'm not saying it's like simple to run this. There's a lot of moving pieces. You know how like there's a lot to coordinate and all of that, but I do try to keep it as simple as possible for the stage of life. And like it used to, you know, people used to always ask me like, what are you building? Are you building a lifestyle business? And I'm going to be honest, I had to Google like, what is a lifestyle business? Because well, I didn't know. And I found
and it's
this demeaning.
And it's weird. And weirdly, yeah. It's 90% of the time, because the type of people who use that term, they use it as a pejorative.
100%. I could tell.
The rest of us are like, well, yeah, that sounds amazing. Like, and they're like, no, it's really bad. And I'm like, yeah. What?
Well, you know what I've come to conclude? Maybe journalism needs a few more lifestyle businesses, because maybe that's more sustainable. We're about to find out.
I feel this is why I wanted to have this conversation, to have more of them, is because there's like two worlds in some ways. There is a world of decline that's happening in the mass media market, particularly general interest. There's protected categories. Bloomberg's going to be fine. The Wall Street Journal will be fine. Politico, you know, it's gone through a little. It's going to be fine. Axios is going to ultimately be fine. Like the amount of money that's going into the federal government. I mean, you cover the SNAPs, $100 billion plus. Like, I mean, these programs are massive. Like, and people looking to influence them, whether you feed at that trough or not, that trough exists.
Yep.
There's a reason that PAC, Semaphore, et cetera, are lining up at the trough. And that's the biggest problem, not the trough itself. Consumer media is just totally different. I mean, they are looking for a lifeline and really scrambling. Whereas this is a really interesting area. And I feel like you're part of, like, I call it like expertise. And I feel like some people have expertise that as a practitioner, you know, you have journalistic expertise that you're, you know, so deeply embedded as like an analyst, really. I mean, you're more than really, I think of like as a reporter, like you have like real expertise in this area. There are so many success cases in this. It's not like it's easy. There's a power law in everything in media, right? But it's working for a lot of people, right?
It's not easy, but there are way more journalists that could be doing this. I mean, just out of Politico, we've had a fair number of entrepreneurial endeavor. I mean, some of them are scaled, right? Axios, Punchbowl. Yeah. Well, Punchbowl's still pretty small, but you know, they have a fairly sizable team now. We also had Rachel Bade, Playbook.
Punchbowl is not small on in like revenue.
Not
at least
revenue.
To me.
No, I think they.
Well,
make,
I would
like,
rather be big in
percent.
Revenue and small in people. That's my.
Yeah. Well, that's what I mean. What I mean by not scaled is like they're not going after a big high traffic. No. That's not what they're going after. They are essential for people in Washington, people covering the policy process. I listen to their podcasts almost every day. Like, I love that they're so focused. I didn't understand when Punchbowl launched how that was going to work. I was like, gosh, there's so many people covering the Hill. But they saw the super hyper-focused white space of just like Congress, hyper-focused. Yeah. And it works really well. Like, if I want to know what's going on the day on that day or that week, like that is the go-to place. Yeah. And you know, the Washington Post has given that up. Like,
it's probably me of like, but I think it's also like, I'll have to talk with Anna or about it, but like, it's also a very savvy, like business, like decision because
they're also
moves,
like 90%.
It
ads,
moves,
not,
but it also, it moves them from being, I mean, from an M&A perspective, because it moves them from trying to compete to be a quote unquote platform business to being additive to someone who already has the platform.
Weren't there rumors for a while that like the Washington Post would buy Punchbowl or something?
And that.
I'm not trying to start rumors.
That makes sense because they can be plugged into someone who already has the platform versus trying to build all the functions of a Politico or an Axios. You don't have a $1 million revenue per employee number to go around with. You don't have the margins because you're spending ahead of, you don't have the scale.
Yeah.
So you have to decide whether or not you're going to build, you know, what the banker type people call like a platform business, which is like, you're going to do it all. You're going to have a sales engine. You're going to have everything. Or if you're going to like prove that you have a narrow and deep and a specialist thing that you can be plugged into like a larger entity, if they want to do that. If they don't want to do that, that's fine.
It'll be so interesting to see what Punchbowl does. I think they've done a great job owning their lane. On that note, I will say, like, because the Washington Post is trying to get more into the space. I think they've hired some former Politico Pro folks. You know, I find it astonishing that the Washington Post let Politico and Punchbowl and all of these entities really own, like, covering the federal government, like
generational
taking that
fumble.
Away from.
And there have been a lot of generational fumbles in media. There have been a lot of fumbles.
I can't even tell you how few, like, food and ag events, House agriculture hearings, you know, whatever, in the weeds, USDA, how few of them I have seen the Washington Post at. They do not treat, they at least in my lane, they have not treated it as this, like, beat. You know, USDA is one of the largest parts of the federal government. And it there's just, they really were very focused on being a national paper and kind of, you know, more like the New York Times model, sort of. And I just think, I mean, again, I'm not a business person. I just think, like, watching it sort of happen feels like a huge strategic mistake. And now look where we are. Like, we have fewer reporters covering the federal government, which is just, like, a bad place to land. So I'm constantly horrified by, like, how few reporters are sometimes at these, like, important events. Although it's a little bit different under MAHA, because now everything's, like, everything's, there's a lot of attention on MAHA. So now there's a lot of reporters at the events that I go to, which is good. I welcome more coverage. I think it's a good thing, because it's very important.
I mean, I don't want to say you got, like, lucky, but, like, it did help that RFK got chosen, right?
For sure.
You're one of the few, like, you get some MAHA bump, maybe.
Food policy has kind of slowly become more mainstream the entire time I've been covering it. But there's no question that MAHA has taken it to a new level. And what it's really done is taken it out of this, like, more left-coded thing. Like, there was a time when, you know, it was Michelle Obama talking about food policy and everyone was like, this is the nanny state. And, you know, Mayor Bloomberg in New York was, like, literally put in a nanny dress. Like, I can't remember which publication it was, put him on the cover. So, you know, that is changing
now.
What,
he tried to ban the soft drinks? I was that. Like,
he was trying to ban the big gulps. Yeah.
When you go after, like, Coke and Pepsi, like, they come. They were like.
But what's interesting is now RFK does not care at all. He bashes them regularly. It's a totally different era. And it's almost like Nixon was the one that could open up China. Like, because you couldn't call him a communist. It was like the right's now, like, they're like, screw soda. We're not doing that in Snap. I mean, it's wild to watch. It's a real, there's a super interesting, like, political realignment that's happened at the same time that it's, like, become more mainstream. So it's a really interesting political story for me to cover.
Right.
Because there's a ton of policy implications, but also I'm watching these, like, fascinating realignments happen. And I can see it because I covered the Obama era. So, like, I have the luxury of focus in that way. Like, I have all this memory of how all this shit went down, right? Because I was there. And so it's been really helpful in that way.
And that perspective really helps, because I think when we're in the moment of, like, great change or realignment, because we're it's not only daily, it's, like, minute by minute, like, that we lose sight of how massive the shifts have been in all kinds of areas in politics, where when you go back 15 years, you're like, wait a second, this was a major issue for the other side. Like, I mean, this is, like, really shocking changes in a lot of these areas that sometimes I think because our politics have gotten so tribal that...
In short term, the cycle, like, the memory is so short term. Yeah.
I mean, just the fact that, there's so many different areas of this. So what, like, percentage of your audience is people who read Food Fix for their jobs?
So I have about a 10% conversion rate from the from the free list to the paid list.
Really? That's great.
Yeah, I'm very proud of that. But I think part of it is that if you're signing up for a food policy newsletter, you're already a little bit more prone to, like, working in the space. Or, like, a good example would be, like, you know, someone who's a food lawyer or someone who works at a regional food bank, like, they might have a budget for media, and so they might get it. And then it's also, like, you know, people who work on Capitol Hill and people who work for the government and people who work at trade associations. So that paid list is mostly people who work in it. There's some random people who are just, you know, have money to burn and are really interested and want to read it. But it is mostly people who work in it. The vast majority of paid Food Fix readers are getting it expensed, and they're renewing year over year because it's just like part of their jobs. And the most churn I have is people switching jobs. That's the biggest thing. And they'll send an email being like, I'm going to resubscribe. I'll, as soon as I get on my new email. So it's sticky. It's a habit. You know, I hear from people all the time. They're like, I wait for it to come. Like I open it when it comes in, right? It's like almost like an event. That's not everyone, but there's definitely some loyal readers who read it right when it comes to their inbox. And it's been great. I mean, I knew there was white space because I saw that the other media outlets weren't seeing this as a beat. So, and even trade publications, there actually isn't a trade publication that just covers food policy. There's a lot of really great agriculture, like production side trade publications. So they're much more focused on like farm subsidies and conservation programs and sort of like the other side of USDA, like the more the production side. So I don't really touch that stuff at all unless there's a big MAHA fight over it. Like today I was writing about pesticides, but that's because there's a big MAHA fight and there's other implications to that. So, the food policy side, there just isn't. Like sometimes Food Dive or these other verticals will touch on it, but it's not their focus. So
do you think of
I kind of have the lane to myself.
Well, do you think of, because I always think, it seems like you're very disciplined about this, when you reach, I don't know, it's like content market fit, right? You think about, okay, well, how do I expand the aperture? You add in, and there's a lot of different, ways to
adjacent.
Do that.
Adjacent, yeah.
Mm-hmm. How do you think about that? Or is that just something you want to stick to like food policy? You don't want to build the the food industry publication?
I'm still kind of deciding. I mean, I get this question a lot, like, what are you building, right? And this used to really stress me out because I didn't really know.
Because you thought you should have an answer. I always thought, I should have an answer.
Yes,
Let me make something up on the spot.
I feel like, I'm really, it's working. I'm considering what to do. And I've started to be less stressed out about this because I'm building this very sustainable platform, this upon which I can either stay the course and build a really strong, loyal Food Fix audience and keep building it brick by brick. And that's great. And that's a success. Or there definitely is space for Food Fix to be broader, to have, I see other niche lanes that are kind of adjacent that would work. And that's just a different path, right? And
you have optionality.
And
I feel like a lot of outside people who haven't been down this path don't quite understand that optionality is really important to people like you, people like me. Having those options is really valuable because going out and going down, you're a small business owner, right? And I don't want to speak for you, but you probably didn't think that you would be running your own business when you went into journalism.
No. I'm also an accidental journalist. So there's a whole other.
There's lots of stuff happens by accident.
Yeah.
But that having optionality, I feel is doubly valuable. And I think it's underrated. I feel like to a lot of, I don't want to say business people, but the people, what I mean? They are the business minded people.
Oh, I know. Yeah.
Because usually they're playing with other, usually they're using other people's money. They're going to make a ton of money one way or the other. And you left Politico and you're I don't know, maybe you didn't have to get the health insurance, but you've got all kinds of
health
things.
Health insurance is a nightmare.
Yeah. You've got two kids and you got bill and you're not guaranteed anything when you start your own business. You start from zero.
You're not guaranteed anything. And that was scary. But, it's interesting. I always felt like I had a lot of job security at Politico. I was really good at what I did. I won them a bunch of awards. I know I made them a lot of money because our team was excellent and they were selling really expensive subscriptions. So I could have stayed there. I had a great job. I felt like I had job security. That wasn't why I left. But what's weird now looking back is I realize I actually have more job security now. I have control over my destiny as a reporter. I get to still practice journalism, hold agencies to account, and do a lot of the same things. I certainly miss, you know, having great colleagues, and there's a lot of, you know, bells and whistles and tools and stuff that a newsroom has that I do not have. But it's honestly been great, and I wish I had done it sooner, honestly. The control, the having the option of like going in different directions, choosing who I work with, like picking editors who make me smarter and are a pleasure to work with, like these small things that I didn't really think about have been great. Like, and I think there are some upsides that I wasn't doing it to have more job security. I didn't think about it that way. But I think in the end, I ended up realizing that it made a lot more sense to do this in a lot of ways, which is just so crazy for me to, it's even crazy for me to hear myself say that, because I would have never thought that I'd be someone who would launch a company. Like, I just wouldn't have thought that. So it's been a great journey, and I'm really actually glad to see a lot more reporters going down this road. I understand many of them will be going down this road against their will, right? They're not necessarily, I think because of all the uncertainty, it's going to force more people to do this. Yeah. But many of them will succeed. Not all of them, but many of them will. And I think there is a future where there are more small, you know, you're either going to do it on expertise or maybe your big scale. Obviously, like the Don Lemon models is different, but people are making it work. And you hopefully will have a whole stable of journalists who are still, you know, holding power to account, fact-checking, and like running solid stories using that model. So I think it's going to be part of the equation going forward.
So the email I referenced, you talked about, you didn't consider yourself a creator, you know, and it probably doesn't line up with the work you do, right? But we don't have, I guess you're just like an independent journalist. I'm not like too hung up on labels. Do you feel like you can be as ambitious journalistically as you were within Politico?
That's a good question. So I am not doing 5,000 word magazine pieces with like amazing graphics that took a team to create. I'm not doing those anymore. I could be partnering with other, you know, media outlets. Right now it's more of a bandwidth thing. I am still, though, holding agencies accountable when they, you know, when their actions don't match their words. Like, I mean, I do that often. So I think it just takes a different format, right? It's much less the typical article format. And it is like a very traditional newsletter format, which is a little more voicey, a little bit more informal. But I still view the function of it to be similar. Like, it has to be informative. It has to have original reporting. And, you know, I've been in this space long enough that like most people will pick up the phone when I call now, you know, like maybe they won't be on the record. But like, I've really been owning this beat long enough that I'm able to write from like a place of authority that is not only helpful for me to run a business that way, but it's helpful for the audience. Like, I get a lot of feedback. People say it makes them smarter in their meetings, which you always like to hear. It makes them understand what's going on better. And that's sort of the goal, is that you're informing people and trying to, you know, I guess shine some lights where you can. But certainly it's different. I'm not writing, you know, these big takeout pieces. And I think places like Politico are struggling with whether or not to do those stories anymore.
Right.
Like, at all, because it takes a lot of resources and you're not getting the same ROI that you once did. So
yeah, it doesn't make sense on a spreadsheet for a lot of, I mean, this is just the reality of the business. And I think one of the knocks of this decentralization, particularly when it comes to journalism, is inevitably, I mean, I'm part of it, like, you know, the economic incentives are to do less reporting. They are, because you're so stretched thin, okay, that, and look, we've all been through this with the aggregators and whatnot. It was like, I would hate, like, we would like work really hard on like a story uncovering something at like Digiday, and then like Business Insider would just
rewrite
it into a slideshow. And I'm like, that's a ripoff.
Yeah.
And I get that, like, you know, there's people who do podcasts, you know, like me, like, and I'm not doing a lot of the original reporting. A lot of the incentives in the, what I call the information space, are to stay on the analytical, or if you're in politics, on the opinion and the shouting and the level. I mean, I think that connecting the dots when done well is I guess it's broadly like journalism, but I think on the hardcore reporting, it's that is the knock. Like whether or not this decentralization will, the, one of the trade-offs will be far less reporting. Like, for instance, there was this controversy, I don't know if you saw, with the Cleveland, like, it's a plane dealer, like, editor, who they were saying to reporter interns that you're just going to be reporting, gathering thing, and then you're not going to be doing the writing. Like, the writing is going to be done through this AI process and whatnot. And a lot of people were outraged, and I kind of got that. You know, I'm a writer, I guess, spiritually. But at the same time, I was like, realistically, it's better for a reporter to be reporting than writing.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. I do think that I've been somewhat helped. I mentioned I was a accidental reporter. I didn't go to journalism school. I wrote my thesis on food policy, and that's how I fell into reporting. It was kind of random. I was interested in the subject matter first. So I did not grow up wanting to be a reporter. I don't have the same romantic attachment or like nostalgia for like the old way of doing things, like the newspaper. Like, you know, a lot of people grew up who wanted to be reporters since they were like five, and they have this very specific idea about how things should work. I am thankful I don't have that. Like, I view reporting as super essential to like a functioning democracy. It's so important. Journalism is very, very important. But I don't have that like romantic sort of, this needs to be done the certain way, we have to have print, whatever. I had a mixed reaction to that as well, because I think that journalists need to be focused on what humans can like very uniquely do that AI cannot. And that is to call people, other people, and talk to them, figure out what is actually going on, talk to them off the record, talk to them on background, like figure out what is actually going on. Go interview people on the street. These are things that, you know, the robots can't do. So we should be focusing on like, what can we do? No one should be spending their time rewriting stories, rewriting press releases. Like, I think that era is gone.
Yeah.
So we have to adapt. We have to change. I get the knee-jerk sort of like, yikes, that is a scary idea that the machines are like deciding which quotes are in or not. But like, that probably is the way the world's going. And like, we need to figure out how to do it responsibly. How to have the right editors. I mean, even AARP is using AI to edit like recall notices. Like, you go to their website, AARP's like, you know, has some of the biggest scale in media. People don't realize this because there's so many people that belong to AARP. And, you know, AARP is using AI to edit like recall notices because, you know, everyone, especially the elderly, who their immune systems are not as strong, like they need to know about recalls. So they're using AI to rewrite those. Well, when I started my career at Food Safety News 15 years ago, I was rewriting recall notices. That's not something reporters probably should be doing anymore.
Yeah.
Unless you're adding some original reporting. And so we are going to have to adapt. We're going to have to change. We need to lean into what humans can uniquely do. I will say, though, I have learned that people love the curation and aggregation, and it's weird. I've actually expanded the like what I'm reading section in the newsletter because I got so much feedback that it was so helpful. And I do think probably eventually that will just all be done by AI. Like, but people freaking love it. They're overwhelmed with information.
Yeah.
And as a reporter, I'm like, this isn't original. I'm not writing this. Why do you people want, you know, why do you want this?
Yeah, I stopped doing it because I was like, oh, this, like, what, shouldn't machines be doing this? But maybe, I don't know. Like,
I have a human help me do it because it, you know, and we really take time to think about like what should be in and what should be out. So maybe that is a uniquely human thing. Yeah.
So you have like five people like working like part, like, so what do you, like, who do you have, like which functions?
So I have two editors. I have a podcast manager. I have a VA and an editorial assistant, and then I have really part-time tech help, like basically like a on-call, like if something. But I will say I use Memberful to, this is not a plug for, no, this is not paid plug for Memberful, but I use Memberful to monetize the site, and they have a really great, really great team, and they're super responsive. And like, so I also have a lot of, if anything ever gets weird, I have a lot of help from them too. So, you know, it's a pretty lean operation, but you know, it takes, you know this, I'm not going to learn how to code anything. I'm just not going
to
do that.
You don't need to do that anymore.
Well, but I don't even know how to not code and make stuff. You know what I mean? Like that, you have to learn how to do that. So,
I think the bigger decision is on the business model side, right? You don't have ads, you don't do events, right? And like,
not yet. I probably will eventually do events.
Okay. Yeah. Cause that's I think those are like the questions, because that is where the complexity comes in.
Yes. Yeah.
Is because when you have clients, you've got an entirely different business.
I'm aware. Yeah.
I spend 80% of my time on things that have nothing to do with the content.
Yeah, I believe that.
And
you've got a lot of events and webinars and like a lot going on. I think about that. I'm like, gosh, his calendar.
It's stressful.
One thing we do have set up.
I'm very jealous of your model.
Well, I want to get into institutional subscriptions, which is more complex to set up. I actually have the tech. I had the tech built to do this, but running the process of institutional subs is a different thing, right? You're talking more high dollar. You got contracts involved. You have some tech, like there's IP.
They have to be sold, it's more complex, too, right?
Yep.
Because everyone wants things bought, and just very few things are bought. Like most things are sold. Like subscriptions are bought, and the reason I think that journalists were very attracted to models like Substack is because
you don't have to do anything.
They didn't want to sell to anyone. And
there's the
church and state thing, but really they didn't want to sell. Like there's type of people. And when I tell this to like people who are like salespeople by nature, like I'm like, there's a lot of people out there who don't like to ask other people for money. Right. And they're like, what are you talking about? I'm like, no, seriously. I'm one of them. Like there's a lot of us out there. And I think a lot of journalists
I don't really send marketing emails. I do. I know people are like, what is wrong with you? But I do, in every
way.
Free newsletter.
I think it's a personality type.
The free newsletter is like top of funnel in a way. Like, so I always have at least two blurbs in there that are like, you know, you're missing out if you're not getting the paid edition. And
yeah, you're good with the consistency.
It's not where I'm not hitting people over the head with it. And also I have like, if someone is on SNAP or WIC or one of these federal nutrition programs, they can get it for free. I just email. And yeah, it's working. So for right now, we're working with it.
Adding a podcast and what job
it's called
is
American
that?
Dish. Everyone should go listen
American
to it.
Dish.
Yeah.
It's a little bit more consumery, I felt like, than I was expecting. So talk to me.
So American Dish launches March 4th. The idea for the podcast is a little bit responding to the moment we're in. So I've been doing this for a really long time. I've been covering food policy for, you know, more than 15 years. And now all of a sudden, everyone is at my party. Like everyone's talking about food policy. We've got all the, you know, there's all the wellness podcast people. There's the Manosphere. There's the Silicon Valley biohackers. Like everyone is now coming to this in different ways. And so I am trying to take a step back and have it be a little bit more consumer facing. Like I'm sitting down and talking to some of the smartest people in the space to zoom out, because so many people are getting their information now from these like super short clips that are super alarmist or black and white or really like oversimplified. And so, you know, being the policy reporter I am, I'm like, let's go into the nuance. Let's like dive into it more. And also we're going to pull short clips out of it. And I refuse to make real. We don't really do social media as like a focus other than LinkedIn, because again, the whole point is to get someone on the free list and then hopefully eventually convert them to paid. I am not randomly finding those people on TikTok. Like that's not, right. You know, and you don't own that channel. So it is a little bit of a play into experimenting more with social, but I have found that podcasts appearing on them in any way, like it's a much more evergreen marketing thing. Like people will find the podcasts from like interviews I did years ago, because they might be searching a particular topic. And so part of it's just an experimentation of like another way to market without marketing. And also I find podcasting very easy compared to writing the newsletter. It's just, you know, I know the people. Yeah. I listen to both your podcasts.
I feel guilty as I do more podcasting because I always thought about it as soft retirement for writers once they got too tired. That's why there's so many middle-aged men doing podcasts.
It's hard to set up. I will say I've spent a lot of time on the pre-launch. Setting it up is a lot of work, way more work than I think I understood. But the actual act of doing it is, and it's very natural for journalists too, because we're curious, we have a lot of questions. I know a lot of these people. So it's easier for me to get bigger names to come on just because I know I've been in this space for a while. And so, but it is a little more B2C. I am not initially monetizing it. I probably will eventually, but we'll see. I don't want anything that is monetized on the podcast will not have a direct conflict. So if anyone wants to sell knives or something that's not anti farm bill or whatever their thing is, right?
Don't take this the wrong way.
Come talk to me.
Even though you're an accidental journalist, this is such a journalist approach.
I know. Oh, I know. I make no apology for selling. You know what? I don't have
selling
anyone to
ads
answer
is, to. A, is horrible and it's so hard. And then a journalist is not only am I going to sell ads, but I'm going to tie both of my arms behind my back and be I have this super valuable niche, and instead I'm going to sell it to the Ginsu knives people instead.
If you're listening, I am open. I will not be covering anything related to, I don't know what their issues are, tariffs related to materials, whatever. I'm all for it. So
talk to me about that. So you're just totally anti-ads then.
I'm not anti-ads. I'm anti-ads that present a conflict or that appear to present a conflict.
Is it because you sell them? Why don't you just have someone else sell them?
Yeah, I could have someone else. But there's just not a lot of distance, and it's still my name that goes in your inbox.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah.
One day when it maybe isn't my name, when it's not as much of an individual, if I go that direction, then that's different.
Have you decided if you want to go that direction, or you haven't decided? Sounds like.
I think I probably eventually will expand with more people, but I do not have an immediate plan to do that. You know, we'll see how it goes. But the toddlers, covering the Trump administration.
Yeah, and so that's a complexity thing. And also, I think one of the things
I think having full-time employees is just a different equation.
Did you manage people at Politico?
Mm-mm. Okay. I mean, I mentored a lot of people. Yeah.
Okay, but that's different.
Yeah, no, it's different. It's different. Yeah.
It's different. I think a lot of people in this area struggle with the first hire.
Yeah.
And I don't mean fractional. I don't mean part-time people getting a podcast producer. I mean first hire.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you have a full-time person?
No, I only have fractional. I went down the path of a full-time hire and I didn't love it. Not really against the person, but
it's hard because what you need is so many different things. It's hard to think about what that role is.
Yeah. Weirdly, in media needs more business, not, it's weird because generalists, really bad, tough area when you're a journalist. Generalists on the business side of media, really valuable, at least to me and to you and other people, because you have real needs that are not full-time jobs. And a lot of people have narrowed and become specialists in too much in some ways because you need them to do three different roles.
Yep.
And at least what I have found is not a lot of people can do that. I guess that's natural. And so you end up going to a fractional approach, because otherwise the reality of these models is a lot falls on you. You just can't outsource, stuff.
But this is part of why I don't do ads, is that I am aware of the operational setup needed to do that. I mean, vaguely, right? And it's more work to show the impact of those ads. It's just a whole other workflow that I don't have. And it's really nice to not have it. What I am seeing happen, which I think is great, is there's more businesses, consultancies, whatever, kind of springing up to serve kind of you and me, whether it's PR targeted to more solopreneurs or even just journalists really specifically, looking at event planning, like live podcast setups. I'm seeing more of that start to happen. And I think that there is a real space for that. Like, you know, maybe you don't have a full-time events person, but you have like a go-to agency or small consultant group where you're like, oh, these are my folks who I bring on. And maybe there's like an arrangement every time that's different about how you make
yeah,
that
this
work.
Is the,
but
this
I,
is
I really
the
think that's missing. Yeah.
To me, that's the infrastructure. Like infrastructure is not just technology, and the tech people will pretend it's just technology platforms. But the reality is no media business is primarily journalists. Journalists are a minority of those businesses. Now, why is that?
Yeah, and they're viewed as cost centers instead of like
There are some things that you know, but like the reality is the publishing function is far beyond, there's a lot of people there doing a lot of different things. Mm-hmm. And when you go to a very lean, independent model, you have to decide which of those things you're going to do because you're going to need infrastructure. And, you know, I think that, and there's a lot of people who are trying to build these kind of things that are basically a shared services model where you can tap into a shared services for growth, for sales, for events, and for other things because it is a lot. Like when you start to add clients, like, I mean, that comes with obligation. It just doesn't come with like money. Like you gotta serve the clients, you gotta do the reports, and you've got to, and the reality is a lot of the monetization outside of subscription is not turnkey. It starts to look like an agency. It starts to look like a content studio.
Yeah.
It starts
and that's a lot of work on your plate. Yeah.
Yeah. So I admire your discipline.
Well, I think the fact that I'm still growing gives me some more runway to like push those decisions off, right? But we'll see. We'll see when the business hits a wall if I still feel
that
way.
Well, it's impressive that you haven't hit a subscriptions wall because usually people who go down your path hit that wall after a couple of years. It's like the first year, it's like amazing, it's growing, it's great and everything. And the reality of any subscription business that I have seen up close is you hit a wall and then it becomes incremental. It becomes optimization tactics. Mm-hmm. And guess what? That's a lot more like specialized work that a lot of like journalists haven't done before.
Oh, I'm going to be consulting people when we hit that because I don't have an interest in spending time on that either. And I think knowing that is good, right? I feel like I'm not going to learn how to do that. I'm going to find someone to do that. You know, do you know what your total addressable market is? Your TAM? I had to like Google all these things, right? Because I was not an entrepreneur. I realized that's also a made up number.
I mean, to me, the TAM stuff is it's done for investors. It's made up. And it's always far bigger than it really is.
Yeah, like, all the media biz people were trying to tell me how to calculate this. And I was like, this is not something I can calculate.
Yeah, and your time is probably better spent like making stuff that's valuable than...
Yeah. But I don't think I've hit... Like, there's still room to grow. So we'll keep trucking along. Yeah, it's... And then, you know, we'll see where this goes. I think Maha has like ripped open a new kind of dimension of food policy. And like, it'll be interesting to see where that goes next. So
sure. I think that just one final question on the Maha stuff and your, cause we've talked all about the business stuff, but I eat. And so I'm interested in this. Can you tell me why those of us who like go take trips to like Europe and whatnot, why? And I'm sure you've gotten this question. I mean, it's kind of like for me, like, you know, being close to the ad tech world, getting asked, like, what are they listening to us on our phones? Because I swear to God, I got an ad right after we talked about this or that. Mm-hmm. Why do we feel better, feel fine? We'll eat pasta all week in Italy and stuff, and we'll feel like light as a feather. And we'll come back here and we feel bloated. And I feel like their Maha has taken off because we keep being told that it's not, no, it's because you walk more. And like, everyone's like, you're just lying to us. You've got to be kidding me.
So, I mean, the truth is we don't know. Like, okay. No one is incentivized to answer that question. Like, who has the financial incentive to answer that question, right? It is so common, though, to hear that discussed. It is so common now that Republicans are praising Europe, right? Because of how much better they feel when they travel there. And that honestly is something it is one of the driving narratives of Baja, is that Europe's food is better than the U.S. I mean, they do have a more precautionary regulatory system. So there's just a lot of things that they just don't allow, like additives, and they're more cautious. That's for sure. But
Fanta tastes different in Europe.
It has different ingredients.
And I constantly feel like United States corporations are serving us. I'm going to get all conspiratorial here.
They're serving us crappier
food and crappier products than they are in Europe. You go to a Starbucks in Europe, it looks totally different than the ones here. Mm-hmm. I'm like, why are we getting the crappy food? Like, we can't even make butter that tastes right. Like, and I don't understand. We have a lot of cows. Mm-hmm. Why does butter taste completely different in Europe?
The regulatory system is totally different, and also it's cultural, right? Like in Europe, they have a much stronger attachment to like local and regional food. And like, I mean, God forbid you call sparkling wine from California champagne,
that's
right?
True.
Like this, there's a lot more.
Like towns in Italy have their own pasta.
Uh-huh. So part of it's culture, but we actually don't know. And like, this is one of my soapboxes that I always get on. There are so many questions about nutrition and health that we have never studied because there isn't a lot of federal investment in it. So like, we don't actually know why people eat more calories when they eat processed food. Like, we don't know the answer to that, even though most of the American diet is now ultra processed. And now everyone's talking about ultra processed food. We like lack basic science around some of these questions. And everyone always asks the Europe thing. Like,
right.
Because you hear like, oh, is it just because I was walking? Am I less stressed? Are people around me less stressed? Because they are. They seem like they're enjoying themselves, right? So what is the food? What is it? Stress? Well, maybe it's all the above. Maybe all those things are working together, that you're on vacation, you're walking more, you're less stressed, and the food is different. I mean, this is a study that could be done. There is actually Todd Wagner, who I think was business partners with Mark Cuban, does a lot of work in this space, like food additives. And he was actually, the reason he got into this is because he would have migraines in the US and they would go away when he went to Europe. And he was just like, are you kidding me? Like, something is not right. And he's actually like helped them pass like additive bans in California and like is working on this. And it is precisely because of that personal experience. And like, we don't have the science to back it up, but like anecdotally, people get really fired up about this. And like, you know, I never dismiss someone's personal anecdote. No,
well,
I'm not.
Enough people have them. And if you have enough experience with it, you're like, this is real. This is true.
Well, you're part of Maha now, Brian.
Yeah,
I don't know if you knew that.
The Mexican Coke. Like, I want the European Fanta to be here because it tastes like fruit juice more than just like whatever it is like here. That's my request.
I will say, for people who are not in the weeds of Maha, mostly right now, we're doing a vibe shift. They're extremely anti-processed foods in their rhetoric, and some states are banning soda from SNAP, but we have not had regulatory change yet. So like, that's very TBD. Like, Maha really does not like ultra-processed foods, but if anyone out there is wondering, like, have we banned anything or what, we have not. So we'll see. Brian, you got to tune in to Food Fix if you want to figure out what's
coming
down
the pipe. When you do the European Fanta episode, have me on as like
there
a little
cameo.
There
we go. Yeah, I'm putting it on the list. That's a great podcast episode.
Thank you, Halish.
Thank you.
Thank you for saying that. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much.